Well, good morning to you. Good to see you all today. We're starting in Revelation 2, but we'll be studying one of the examples that Jesus draws the church in Pergamum to, and that's in Numbers 25. So if you need some extra time, heading over to Numbers 25, you can get started now. Today's lesson can be about a lot of things, but it's about the goodness of God's teaching, and it's about the patience of God with his people as they try and accept this teaching. I'll try and remember to reiterate this again at the end, but today is about the goodness of what God teaches for his people and about his patience with them as they receive what he has taught. How are you when you are sick? Usually we can bear quite heavy loads of stress and work and whatnot when we're healthy, but which one are you when the bug finds you? Are you a silent sufferer? Or are you like me and you regress into some infantile state of dependency and crying? It's amazing how devastating attacks on the inside can be. Man, people can do a lot when they're healthy, but something little and microscopic gets inside and infects us, and it takes us down for the count, and we're grumpy, and we're needy. Satan's goal in Revelation chapter 2 and Numbers 25 is to get God's people to be devoted to anything except for him, except for God. Satan wants the church in Pergamum, and he wanted Israel in the book of Numbers. He wanted them to be devoted, to be committed, to be drawn to be obsessed with anything except for God. Satan's goal was idolatry. It's not a word that we use a lot today, but it is the fountain of so much of what we struggle with. What had Satan already tried in Pergamum? He had tried to persecute them, and he had tried to oppress them. And they bore up under that load of persecution admirably. And yet where he failed to curse them and oppress them and overtly force them into idolatry, he takes a different approach, and he weakens the body in Pergamum, right? The church, the body. He weakens that body. He weakens the body, the community in Numbers 25, by infecting them with destructive messages. Now, if this is about idolatry, why is Jesus talking about sexuality? Did you notice the teaching of Balaam? It's idolatry and what else? Thanks a lot, Jesus. Now I have to get up here and talk about God's intent for sexuality, right? We're talking about idolatry, and so why is Jesus telling them that this is where their struggle is? Because when Satan can't get at us overtly and force us into idolatry, when he can't curse God's people, then he'll seduce them into idolatry anyway that he can. And he'll feed them destructive messages that slowly infect and eat at the body from the inside out. There's comfort for me as a preacher I'm going to preach a series of lessons because you know what you're going to preach week to week. But then at the same time, there's this frustration that, okay, that's what I have to talk about this week, right? It's the next thing in the order. And so that's part of why I force myself into these series, because I think it helps to offer a balanced diet. Some things are easier to talk about and some things aren't. Let's turn back to Numbers 25. Already, I hope you're getting a sense that in order to understand the struggle in Revelation, we have to go all the way back to God's people in Numbers 25. This is 1400 BC, give or take 50 so 50 or so years. This is a long time ago, 3,000 years ago. And yet when it's time for John to talk to this church in Revelation, he says, you know, God's people have been struggling with this issue for thousands and thousands of years. And God's teaching has always been the same. It's always been good. And so I hope you're getting a sense that God's teaching is good and that it's always been good and that he is incredibly patient with his people. Numbers 23, let's get some of the backstory before we understand Balaam's teaching here. This is part one. We have to study Numbers 25 before we can get into Revelation 2. And I didn't want to fit it all into one lesson. So we have this painting of Pergamum and this painting of Israel. Basically, Rome in the first century, Israel over 3,000 years ago. And yet they struggle with a common difficulty and frustration. Numbers 22, do you remember this exchange that goes on here? Numbers 22, verse 1, the people of Israel set out and camped in the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan at Jericho. And so if you can picture Israel and Jerusalem, and to the east is the Jordan River, and they're just on the other side. And so they're coming through, and they're just whooping up on all of the enemies of God. And they come to Moab, and Moab knows what's coming. Verse 2, Balak the son of Zippor saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites, and Moab was in great dread of the people because there were many. Moab was overcome with fear of the people of Israel. And Moab said to the elders of Midian, this horde will lick up all that is around us. As the ox licks up the grass of the field. So Balak, the son of Zippor, who was king of Moab at the time, sent messengers to Balaam, son of Beor, at Pethor. There's Balaam. Is that where that phrase, we're going to lick them, comes from, you think? The Israelites are coming and they're licking everybody. Why? Is it because Israel's awesome? No, they're a bunch of slaves who just got out of slavery. Do they have an awesome military? No, it's why? It's because God is their God. And Balak knows that if I don't sever them from their relationship from God, we are toast. They're going to lick us. So he goes to Balaam, and Balaam is this weird prophet who he knows he can't contradict God, but as we'll find out, he's not really a trustworthy fellow anyway. And so Balak goes to Balaam, and he says, I just need you to go up and curse these people. Please, curse these people. And so Balaam gets up, and do you remember what happens? He's about to pronounce a curse on Israel, and what comes out of his mouth? Do you remember? He just starts blessing the people of God. And Balak is like, oh, just read it with me here. 23, verse 11. And Balak said to Balaam, what have you done to me? I took you to curse my enemies, and behold, you have done nothing but bless them. And this is just the first time that this happens. It happens a second time, and a third time, and a fourth time. Chapter 24, verse 9, this is all that Balaam can manage. Blessed are those who bless you, Israel, and cursed are those who curse you. And Balak's anger was kindled against Balaam, and he struck his hands together. And Balak said to Balaam, I called you to curse my enemies. And behold, you have blessed them three times. If so many lives weren't at stake, it would almost be comical, right? Each time Balaam steps up to try and bless the people and to curse them, and all that comes out is a blessing. And Balak, it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse for him. God is providing for his people, and they don't even know it. God is thwarting this curse that Balaam is trying to bring across them, and they have no concept. God is fighting for them. He's a good God. And yet, where Balaam fails to curse God's people, he takes a different strategy. He tries to infect them with destructive messages. Go over to chapter 31. 31 verse 15. This is after the story that we're going to talk about occurs. This is after. So we're going to have to fill in some gaps here. But Moses reveals what Balaam's tactic was. His curses fail. And Moses says in verse 16, behold, Numbers 31 verse 16, these on Balaam's advice, so he's talking about these women of Midian and of Moab, on Balaam's advice, caused the people of Israel to act treacherously against the Lord in the incident of Peor, so the plague came among the congregation of the Lord. So where Balaam failed to curse, where did he succeed? He infected them with destructive messages. And there's a lot of destructive messages that God's people face, and so I don't want to elevate our struggles with sexuality as like the greatest sin or the unforgivable sin. But no doubt about it, it's what the people in Pergamum struggled with in chapter 2 of Revelation. And it's what Numbers, the people in Numbers struggled with in chapter 25. So we got to understand what Balaam's message is and what a proper Christian response would be to this. Go back to Numbers 25. Flip back over there as I segue into our observation of the messages here. I want to give you the format that I'll be going through here. Strengthening our immune response. Okay, so the first thing we're going to do is we're going to clarify the destructive messages that Balaam is teaching these people. We're going to clarify those so we understand what it is the enemy's trying to do. And then we're going to try and articulate the reverse, the good teaching of God that was as applicable thousands of years ago as it is today. And then, of course, along the way, we'll explore some arguments that are destructive. Now, I didn't come up with this. There's some authors, Stan and Brenna Jones, who address these issues in some of their books. They're good authors. It's good for family education. But this is just so you know where I'm going with this. What is Balaam's message? Do you know what Balaam's message was? I didn't know what it was. And then I started to read that Paul knew what it was. He talks about this same story in 1 Corinthians. And 2 Peter talks about the dangers of Balaam's teaching. And Jude talks about the dangers of Balaam's teaching. So we've got Moses, and we've got Peter, the apostle, and we've got Paul, and we've got Jude, and we've got John and Jesus talking to us about this. I think they understood that this is a struggle of God's people. But you go from Moses and you go to Jesus, that's thousands of years, and here we are today. God's teaching is good for all time. Have I said that enough yet? Do I need to keep saying that? Numbers 25, verse 1 through 9. This is a difficult story. While Israel lived in Shittim, the people began to prostitute themselves with the daughters of Moab. They invited the people... The daughters of Moab invited Israel to the sacrifices of Moab's gods, and God's people ate and bowed down to the gods of the Moabites. So Israel yoked himself to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. The Lord said to Moses, "Take the chiefs of the people and hang them in the sun before the Lord, impale them in the sun before the Lord, that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel." And Moses said to the judges of Israel, "Each of you kill those of his men who have yoked themselves to Baal of Peor." And behold, so after that had happened, like that's bad enough. Verse 6, one of the people of Israel came and brought a Midianite woman to his family. They've already been busted for the wrongdoing, and now this guy has the arrogance to go and get a woman to bring her to his family in the sight of Moses and in the sight of the congregation of the people of Israel while they were weeping in the entrance of the tent of meeting. When Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he rose and left the congregation and took a spear in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the chamber and pierced both of them, the man of Israel and the woman, through her belly. Thus the plague on the people of Israel has stopped. Nevertheless, those who died by the plague were 24,000. Can you believe these stories are in the Bible? This is real stuff. Let's go back to verse 2. So God's people, Balaam advises the women of Moab. He says, I can't curse their God and them, but if you will go seduce these men and get them to come to bed with you, I think they will. And so they do that. And he introduces this message, this destructive message, that if consequences can be avoided or improved, then really any behavior is okay. You know, a lot of times, you know, the Bible will preach against the negative consequences of sexual activity outside of marriage. But there's ways of getting around those consequences. And in fact, Moab had ways of getting around those negative consequences. Here's the thing about Baal. Baal was this like perverse fertility god. And so what they would do is in their cult worship, in the Moabites' cult worship, they would have prostitutes, male and female, and someone would go in and they would be intimate with that prostitute. And it wasn't without some kind of logical reasoning. I'm not saying it's moral. I'm saying there was logic to it. They thought by that type of worship, they would appease Baal and Baal would bless them with crops. And so they found a way to add this positive consequence to this teaching that was against God. They said, hey, this will give us, Baal will bless us and he will bless our crops, so we might as well. And maybe Israel thought, well, the women are beautiful and hey, it wouldn't hurt, right? If we can get away from the negative consequences. If consequences can be avoided or improved, then any behavior is allowed. Let me be clear, this is what Balaam was teaching them. Is God happy about this? No, he's not. And so what does he say? His anger burns against Israel. It's kindled. And so he says, Moses, take the leaders who let this happen, and I want you to take them and impale them upon these stakes, and so that they may be cursed by God. Now, there's a reason that judgment here, not that sins today like this make God any less angry, but there's a reason that judgment is so swift. Can you think about why we get such swift judgment here? Because the people of Israel had essentially signed a covenant saying, God will accept your blessings, but we will also accept your curses. Go read Leviticus 20. Go read the curses and blessings in Deuteronomy. I mean, they knew that God had told them, I will curse you if you disobey me. We live in a covenant today where those curses are not immediately rained down upon us, but it affects us no less, as we'll see in here. So they punish these men. And can you imagine the community, how much mourning and sorrow there would be? And so they're standing before God and they're mourning and they're sad. And in the midst of this national mourning, a man continues to engage in disobedience. And this is where we get verse 6. One of the people of Israel. I mean, this is a guy who was a card-carrying Israelite, if you will. He professed that his religion was Israel, was Judaism, and that God was his God. And yet there was a disconnect. Balaam had fed them this message that your spiritual beliefs don't really require physical obedience. That your physical life is separate from that. And that, heaven forbid, you insist other people be obedient to God. So he takes this woman in, and he brings this woman to his family. I mean, he's really been infected with some of these messages, because he's not even trying to hide it. He brings it to his family in front of the whole congregation and engages in continued immorality, taking a gift that God had given Israel and using it for his own benefit. Because he thought, you know, obedience, I can be spiritual without being obedient. We come down to verse 9. Nevertheless, those who died by the plague were 24,000. I mean, hey, we just have two consenting adults here, right? I mean, no one's getting hurt. We have two women, we have a man and a woman who are consenting, and they're not hurting anyone else, and so why is this such a big deal? We're not supposed to judge this man's behavior, but he's free to broadcast it. Isn't that kind of the way our world treats issues of sexuality today? People can broadcast their beliefs, but hey, don't judge me. It's my private life. You keep out of my private life. The teaching that Balaam was spreading was that someone's personal life is not the concern of the community, and that what goes on in the inner chamber between a man and a woman is really no one else's business. And Balaam had talked them into believing that destructive message. Accepting these messages is always a clear step toward rejecting God and harming his community. Do these messages persist today? If you read literature from organizations like Planned Parenthood, these are some of the foundations of what they teach about healthy sexuality. Some sex education programs, some of these destructive messages are turned into, this is how healthy adults ought to live. But whatever, who is God speaking to in Revelation chapter 2? Is God speaking to Planned Parenthood? Is Jesus speaking to them? I mean, he will. He'll speak to those who cause others to stumble. Be sure about that. But who is Jesus speaking to for our purposes and for this lesson today? He's speaking to the church. And he says, you need to be able to identify these destructive messages and have nothing to do with them. So I'd like to spend the rest of our time today. I appreciate your patience with our extra collection. We've extended things a little bit today. I'll try and keep this brief, but bear with me, please. Let's articulate God's eternal truth. Let's take these things that Balaam had used to infect the congregation, and let's consider what God's edifying truth is. First of all, avoiding negative consequences are only part of why we follow God's laws. I mean, it's a good reason, right? Negative things can happen when we take God's gift of sex and use it in a way that's not intended. But you know, there's plenty of ways to get around that today that can't be the foundation of our teaching. Our life as Christians isn't just about avoiding bad things happening to us. I mean, sometimes you do the right thing and bad things happen to you, right? Is our behavior always rewarded in this life? Not always. It's not an automatic risk and reward situation that we're in. And so we have to go beyond merely threatening with negative consequences. Now, obedience. Sometimes we turn obedience, or we think about it as this kind of a, I don't know, not very spiritual. But Jesus, who is God and who was with God from the beginning and was obedient to God from the beginning, came down and took a physical form. And he was obedient to God in his physical form. Obedience is our physical expression of our spiritual love for God. It is an incarnation of the spiritual love we had and making it real. You can't separate our physical lives from our spiritual devotion and religion to God. But perhaps the linchpin, perhaps the most edifying truth, is that our personal choices inevitably affect the community. The things we do in our personal lives, be they good or bad, affect our community. Now, you can take this line of reasoning too far, and you can say that, well, we shouldn't have personal lives. We should be fully aware of what everything is going on inside each other's lives. No, there's a difference between modesty, right? And modesty isn't just women in yoga pants, right? This isn't just an issue about telling women what not to wear and what to wear. Okay, modesty is saying the right thing and wearing the right thing in the right circumstance. The personal choices that a husband and wife make in the privacy of their bedroom is their private business. But make no mistake, the healthier that relationship is, and the better they can communicate about their relationship, that blesses all of us in ways that we always can't see. Jesus Christ and Paul, examples of people who lived celibate lives. This isn't just for married people, okay? People who walked in the purity of what God had given them blessed the community by that how they conducted themselves in their personal lives. The things we do privately affect the community. Let me read these two quotations for you. God means intercourse for marriage, and it is meant to be, and it is a uniting event and a uniting force. Our sexuality is not this meaningless thing that you just say, well, as long as I'm not hurting anyone, it's okay for me to use it however I want. No, God intended it to be a unifying activity and a unifying event. There is objective meaning to God's gift. Oops, didn't mean to click that away. And so we extend that into marriage, the shelter for this activity. Marriage, in other words, is not meant simply for pairs of people who are in love. I mean, hopefully it's involved with people who are in love. But marriage is not God's answer to, what am I going to do with these people who are in love? Oh, I'll let them marry each other. No, marriages are institutions out of which cultures and societies are formed. It's not for us to decide how to define marriage and for what marriage ought to be. God says, this is what I'm going to build my societies and my families upon. And whether you're single or married, it's our obligation to uphold God's standard for what he has given to us. Honoring God in our personal life strengthens the body, and it affirms our faith in God. So let me close with this application. Is it some comfort to you that God's people have always struggled with this? I know in my personal struggle for purity, and I've struggled with these issues on a deep level. But it's comforting to know that I'm not the only one, and I'm not the only one who has failed and made mistakes and needed forgiveness in my past. God is able to be patient with his people. And yet, we accept God and we worship the God whose design for our relationships is what we want to uphold. His design is timeless, and it is timely. The same advice he gave to the people in Numbers is the same teaching that applies to us today. Satan's just running around trying to find different ways to cause us to stumble. And so what about our application? What does Pergamum do with this? Well, you'll have to come back in a couple weeks when I preach again and we follow up on that. But for that church, there's some interesting symbols that have to do with forgiveness and provision and repentance that we'll look at. But here's what I'd like you to challenge you to do today. As you are in your communities and in your jobs and at school and you watch movies and you read books, articulate culture's destructive messages specifically in regards to our intimate lives. And what's the appropriate Christian truth that could respond to that? Be aware, articulate the destructive message, and be able to apply a Christian truth in response. And for every individual here who is fighting that fight and struggling to be pure in their relationships, for every marriage that is striving for intimacy and communication, you are to be praised because you bless this church every day. Accepting God's teaching is accepting him as our one true God. Bless you in your attempt to follow your obedience with love, and to uphold God's intent for our relationships. Thank you for bearing with me today in our extended time, and we'll have an opportunity here. If there's anyone who needs to be baptized into Christ or come back into fellowship with his church, you may come forward now while we stand and sing.